Welcome to Deeply Disturbing Things,
the podcast.
I'm Macy.
And I'm Naomi.
And we're two professional counselors that like to talk about deeply disturbing things.
And tonight we have a very special guest
in the
house, briefly popping in for a visit. This is my son, Skylar.
Hello.
Eldest child.
Yeah, I'm sick and I'm here briefly to kind of slip in some knowledge, I guess, or at least a conversational topic, I guess.
Perfect. He usually works on Monday nights, but he called in sick. Don't get us sick.
That's why he's over there.
That's why I am sharing a mic with him. Because if I'm going to get it, I'm going to get it probably anyway.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to share with us?
Well, I'm from a group and we've been together now. I guess it started before I was involved, like 6 years ago. But we're going strong, like 5 years in now.
We're
a music group, but I consider us more multimedia, which actually kind of is a segue into sort of what our group is kind of all about, I guess, a little bit. Like we're not super focused on what our name is at the moment. You know, we're not super about that.
But what is your name?
But our name is Apophaniacs, and that is a cross between apophenia, which is something that happens in the mind, and the Animaniacs, which is a show.
Animaniacs. In case you needed the context.
Yes, and my friend Daniel, who's in the basement as we speak, he came up with the name like 7 years ago. We never really were able to think of anything more original, you know. But it does have a little bit of lore, has a little depth. What we take from Animaniacs is like how the show breaks the fourth wall, and we like cartoons, stuff like that. And apophenia itself is a sort of disorder that can happen, you know, to anyone really. Even I experience apophenia sometimes. A common apophenia is people see faces in objects. And just misinterpreting things.
Are you talking like how people may see like Jesus in their toast?
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's okay. Definitely okay. An example. I mean, like even I kind of like can look in a ceiling sometimes and see maybe like a nose and some eyes. I think more creative people might see apophenia just because it's like instinctual, like seeing things a little bit more differently. But there's like more serious cases of apophenia where it's like more like a psychosis. Mm-hmm. I would say it's a little more severe.
Well, we talked about synesthesia on our last one, which kind of relates. Oh, yeah. But I definitely could see how that could cause problems if you have trouble recognizing or faces, which tends to come in infancy of facial recognition.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Another place that apophenia kind of weirdly exists is gambling, like reading cards and stuff. It's all about patterns. In the end, apophenia is all about patterns. So like conspiracy theories, people who come up with conspiracy, everyone's a conspiracy theorist, sort of, you know, you might see patterns here, you know, here and there.
Is it like seeing signs and symbols?
Kind of. It can be anything. It can be.
Would like numerology fall under that umbrella then?
Probably.
Yeah. Like the whole 27 thing.
It's just stuff that is pretty interpretable. Mm-hmm. But speaking of,
you came prepared with notes.
Yeah, I have a couple notes. Speaking of,
good job.
Of Apophaniacs, the group, what we take from apophenia, I guess, musically, is how we definitely are a little more experimental than the average group with our noise. And I would say that people like our listeners might experience apophenia, sort of picking out certain sounds to listen to in the mix, I guess, and putting those patterns together themselves, sort of.
Like jazz.
Kind of like jazz. Yes. I would say that we're kind of jazzy, kind of futuristic at the same time. We're definitely, in the end, we're a hip hop group, but I definitely am not all about labels. Like, I think we're our own thing. We're the Apophaniacs.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Well, anything else you want to add?
Yeah. Where can people, if they're interested in listening to your music, where can they go? Go ahead and get your plug out of the way. Easiest way to
spell it out. It's APOPHENIAKS.
Are you on the SoundCloud?
We're on SoundCloud and Facebook.
Sweet.
Can you say the name one more time for everybody?
Apophaniacs.
Got some cool jams. Unlabeled, unclassified. You may see a face in the music.
Yeah, you'll see a lot of Daniel, who is Sleuth, and some Walt Dipsy. Kind of in the background, and more of the producer. They're more in the foreground. But yeah, that's about it for me.
Sweet. Maybe you should get your germs out of here now.
Yep.
Thank you for sharing.
No, good luck with the podcast.
Thanks. Bye,
I'm glad you were finally around on a podcast night.
Me too.
Feel better.
his friend Daniel spent the night last night. And it's always like, you don't know he's weirdly sleeping in front of my washer and dryer in the basement. And it will scare the shit out of you if you're like doing some laundry and then all of a sudden a body shifts right next to you.
That would scare me. I would be terrified.
No, it's terrible. I've started looking for clues in the morning to see if his shoes are around. Then I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna avoid the basement. No laundry for me today.
Well, I'm glad he got to come and plug his music group.
He has a good voice for the radio.
Yeah, that like deep, like blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah. As I drink a sip of cider and try to talk. This cider is very juicy.
Shilling hard cider. It's got a giraffe on it and an astronaut's hat.
Yeah.
I don't think they wear hats.
A helmet. Imperial apple. It's num num.
Yeah, it's a nice punch in the face.
Trader Joe's. It's like a medium punch in the face.
Medium. Yeah. I can't take a hard punch right now.
I learned a new something not to say in therapy.
Oh, I love these moments. Do tell. Oh, we should. It's another book we should write at some point. The things not to say in therapy.
So I was just wrapping up the old sesh, as you do, you know, at the end.
You know, yeah, summarizing, planning.
And I just said, okay, so I'll see you next Tuesday. And the client just like froze and was like, did you just tell me see you next Tuesday? And I was like,
what? Yeah,
I did. And I was like,
I say that a lot for clients on Tuesdays.
And then I was like thinking like, was it not Tuesday? I'm like looking at my calendar. And then she like is like, don't you know what that means?
And I said,
no.
What?
What does it mean? And then I was horrified, like, oh my God. She goes,
you like did some faux pas.
C-U-N-T. I was like, oh shit.
Wait, C U
N T. What does that spell?
Well, yeah, no, I get that, but how does that tie in? I guess
it's a thing.
But see you on Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Oh, see you next Tuesday. Yes. Oh.
So now
spelling it. Got it.
If I'm ever having a client on a Tuesday, I gotta really watch what I say.
I like, who knows that? That's, did anybody who's listening apparently know it's that? A thing,
and now I know.
See you next Tuesday.
Knowing's half the battle. Yeah, so don't say that to a client. Don't do what I did.
I feel like I'm going to just do it more now, just subconsciously. It's just going to come out. Yeah, yeah. Would Thursday be the same?
Maybe.
See you next Thursday. It's the same.
I mean, it would be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it has the same meaning out on the streets.
Street slang.
Yeah.
They may let that one slide.
But I was glad to learn something new.
You know? Tuesday, getting the brunt of it.
It made me all sweaty, though.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what was happening. It was one of those moments, like, I had no idea what was going on. Like, something was going on, but I didn't know what. It was very disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I don't like those moments. When I'm sitting there and I'm like, I did something wrong.
But I don't know what it is.
Boy, I hope they're going to tell me. Oh, yes. Okay. So, any specific check-ins for you?
That was my main check-in.
I'll let that be my main check-in too. I finished my second round of kombucha. I'm like into it now. No, third. This is my third round. And I made regular flavor this time, and I didn't bring it for you because I'm a bad friend.
It's okay.
Next time.
It's the thought.
Is it? Is it?
No, I can't drink a thought.
No, sorry.
A thought is not going to help with my gut health.
Oh, I'm all about, I can no longer eat fast food. My insides wreck.
They've rebelled.
Hardcore. Okay. You're welcome, fans. You get to know that. Okay, so you actually start today.
Okay.
What you got? What you working with?
Murder.
She wrote.
I am going to tell you.
She's going to read.
About a sad murder. This is an unsolved murder. I'm all discombobulated in my seat. Hold on. Because I moved over to be next to Skylar, but now I'm not in front of my laptop. And you know I can't see anything.
Where are your glasses?
I know. Why am I squinting? They're right here.
Okay.
And so I'm going to talk about the unsolved murder of 9-year-old Amber Hagerman. This is the 25th anniversary of her death. And so maybe somebody out there knows something, saw something, and could come forward and solve this. So this is the story of the little girl that the Amber Alert is named for.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So coincidentally, just a couple months before Amber was abducted and killed, the local television station in Arlington, Texas, WFAA, had been filming the family for a documentary about getting off welfare. So there's tons of footage of Amber and her family, and it really adds a lot of nice context to her life. Because I think sometimes we can lose touch that this is a real living, breathing person at one time that was, you know, vital.
Unsolved. So she still could be, right?
No, it's unsolved in that we don't know who killed her.
Oh, okay. So we know she's dead.
We know she's dead. Yes.
Thank you.
Sadly.
Yes.
So there's all this footage, and the reporter that was doing the documentary got very, you know, attached to Amber during that. And then, of course, when this came out, the family invited her and the crew back in, like, right after this all happened. And so there's all this footage of, like, in their house, in their lives, going through this, which was very sad, but also very kind of interesting to just see what that process looks like while it's playing out, not, you know, reading about it later. So let's talk about the abduction. January 13th, 1996 in Arlington, Texas. And if anybody that's listening lived in that area at that time, you might know something that could help solve this. So Amber and her mom and brother went to her grandparents' house. And as soon as they, you know, got there, her and her brother, her little brother, who was five, tore off on their bikes like they do. They were super close. They loved playing together. They loved riding bikes. They were supposed to just.
Started playing tug of war with our headphone cords. Sorry, we're connected.
Like, why am I being pulled towards you? And then I tried to pull it back and then you ran towards me. That was weird.
Sorry.
Okay. So they were supposed to just stay around the block. You know how it is. Like, okay, just stay on the block. But as Amber and her little brother Ricky rode off, they spotted a cool ramp in the parking lot of an empty Winn-Dixie grocery store.
And you know what you do with a cool ramp?
You ride on it with your cool bike.
Absolutely.
Yep. So it, like,
every time
called to them. And so even though they were, like, off the block, they were only 0.2 miles from their grandparents' home. But then little Ricky, he remembered that they'd been told, you know, to stay on the block. And so he headed back home. And then he showed up and Amber wasn't with him. Minutes later, a 78-year-old man who lived down the street witnessed a sight through the chain link fence that separated his backyard from the strip mall where the Winn-Dixie was. So this witness was named Jimmy Kevel, and he said that he saw Amber riding up and down and that she was by herself. And then he said, "I saw this black pickup." He pulled up, jumped out, and grabbed her. When she screamed, I figured the police ought to know about it, so I called them. Amber also tried to kick the man as he forced her into the truck, the witness said. So he is the only witness, and he died a couple months after this.
Aww.
So he wasn't even able to go back and be re-interviewed later.
Yeah, or to testify.
Try to find more information. Mm-hmm. So he was a U.S. Navy veteran, and a former sheriff's deputy. So he was like good at like spotting the details. Oh, I got those to share with you. It's a little snack. They're really weird. They're baby bananas.
I've been looking at them on the table this whole time and
I forgot I put them
in. I don't know what a baby banana is.
Open it up. They're fucking weird looking.
Do they look like a little baby banana?
They look like a little dried up pinky finger.
Ew.
But they taste real good.
Oh, it smells like banana.
Yeah, it's real good.
Yeah, they look disgusting. I just put this in my mouth.
Yeah, just eat it. It's delicious.
It looks like a slug.
A dried up slug, yeah. But it tastes amazing. What do you think?
It's amazing.
Told you. You will have eaten that whole bag within a half hour. So this witness, Kevel, he was a U.S. Navy veteran, a former sheriff's deputy. So he was able to provide details to the police. He knew, you know, what to be observant about. So he rushed, called 911. And then he saw the kidnapper pull out of the parking lot and head west on Abram Street. He described Amber's abductor as a white or Hispanic man in his 20s or 30s, under 6 feet tall, with a medium build and brown or black hair. His truck, a single cab pickup, was in good condition and was solid black with no chrome or stripings. Police have said that the truck is believed to be a 1980s or 1990s full-size fleet-side pickup with a short wheelbase and a non-sliding clear rear window. So if you lived in that area at that time and saw this truck, or maybe you know somebody that had a truck like this.
Or if it's you, found.
Turn yourself in immediately. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Get no baby banana.
You get nothing.
No hula hooping, no nothing.
When Ricky returned to their grandparents' home alone a few minutes after he and Amber had left, the family members immediately went looking for Amber. All they found was Amber's pink and white bicycle that she had gotten for Christmas less than a month before. And the police officers were already at the Winn-Dixie. So Amber's grandfather showed up at the same time looking for her as all this was going on. And then he had to go back to the house and break the news to the family that someone had gotten Amber.
Mm-hmm. It's like a family's worst nightmare.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You just think your kids are just riding around the block and then you never see them alive again. It's just terrible. Amber's mom, Donna, said she went crazy then and ran towards the place where her dad said Amber had been when she was abducted. And she screamed Amber's name over and over, hoping she would answer her because she's probably in shock.
Yeah.
And denial and all the things. It took exactly 8 minutes for Amber to be abducted after leaving her grandmother's home.
Hmm.
That's how fast it happened.
I wonder if this person like scouts the neighborhood, like how much planning that takes, or if it was just a happen, like the odds of it happening, somebody driving by and grabbing her, or was it more calculated than that?
I think it was a predator that seized an opportunity that saw her momentarily alone in this parking lot of a closed store. So not a lot of people around, but there was a witness, and there may have been more witnesses that just haven't come forward.
So this is an actual banana.
Yep. That's all it is a baby banana.
You see the little end of the banana. I didn't know they grew so little.
Yeah. They take them from their mothers at a young age.
Is it like a actual banana, just baby size?
Yeah.
You mean like genetically made baby size?
No, it's a young banana.
They all taste like big banana?
I guess so.
Like dried big banana?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating. Another Trader Joe's item. So the family immediately started making flyers because you're pushed to action. Like you want to do something. And what can you do? Well, you can make flyers and you can put them all around town. So they had those up around town within hours, homemade flyers. They had Amber's photo on there, her description. So she was age 9, 4'11", long brown hair with bangs. She was a member of the Bang Gang, like us. So she was kidnapped on January 13th, 1996 at 3 p.m. Donna stood outside the family home watching and waiting for Amber to return until the police told her she should go inside because all the news was starting to arrive outside her house.
So, I would just be angry. Like, I would just, I'd probably be the one freaking out if I was the parent.
Oh, yeah. I would have to be sedated.
Yeah. Just jab me in the neck with something, drag me to the back room and do your business.
Yeah. Donna wanted to be in the limelight and let as many news stations know that her daughter was out there somewhere so they could get the word out. It was clear that Amber had not gone voluntarily with the individual who took her. Sometimes Amber's parents spoke on camera to her abductor in tears, begging the abductor not to hurt their little girl. And sometimes they spoke directly to Amber.
In case she saw it.
Yeah, so sad. So there were searches done in the area, but since her kidnapper had a pickup truck, he could have gone far, far away right away. And so even though they did do searches, you know, in neighborhoods and parks and things, really, he could have been out of there. As the days passed and the police found nothing, her family prayed and cried and hoped. Donna begged the police to find her little girl and said that she wanted her home now. So these flyers went up everywhere. Volunteers helped. When the reporter was doing the documentary, Amber showed off her book full of school awards. And that was in November, so 2 months before she got abducted. And the reporter's name was Pam Curry, and she was covering the family for the documentary on getting off welfare. So Amber showed off her awards for being on the honor roll, and she always had perfect attendance.
Aww. And had bangs.
And she had bangs. Donna had left her husband, Richard Hagerman, the previous year. She had said it was an abusive relationship. She took her two children and moved into a women's shelter, and she wouldn't accept any child support from Richard out of principle, which I get. I can relate. I mean, I took child support, but I get it.
You get the concept.
I get it. Yeah, I can get how that would be the right choice for some people. At the time of the filming of the documentary.
You do you.
Yeah. Donna was on her own for the very first time and really expressed how she appreciated the value of an education because she had dropped out of school in seventh grade and she understood like how education gives you opportunities and allows you to be able to live independently, which was really important for her. So Donna was very proud and supportive of Amber. And Donna did end up achieving her high school equivalency degree and was receiving job training and volunteering at the welfare office when they were filming the documentary. She was working really hard to support herself and was confident that she would succeed.
Was the film documentary, was that released before or after the abduction?
Good question. Do you think the
abductor
saw Amber? And
yeah, I'm just wondering if, like, if it was a little more targeted, like maybe he spotted her and got some obsessive thoughts about it, and then, like,
you know, that's a really
scoped out the area. And
good question.
Maybe it was, that makes the strategic piece make more sense if he knew her, saw her, obsessed about her, and then planned it.
I didn't read anything about that theory, so you may be onto a unique theory there.
I'm gonna find you.
So we just need to know if that was filmed or released before or not.
Okay.
Donna's intention was to raise her two children in a quiet, calm, loving home so they would be successful in their futures. And right before Amber was abducted, all her dreams were within her reach. She was achieving it all.
Killing it.
And then, you know, these documentaries, these film footage by the news station WFAA shows Amber is very sweet, very curious little girl. She was a brownie. Oh,
I don't know what that. Oh,
it's like a pre-Girl Scout.
Okay.
You know, she's
not my era, not my thing.
She has friends. Well, they still have brownies and Girl Scouts.
I don't.
I was a bluebird.
All
I
know
was not a Girl Scout.
Is these really persistent children come at me at storefronts, and I have to go in the side door?
Not me. I'm like, where's all them cookies? Load me up. I want this and this and this. Four of each.
Just throw a $10 at them and run away, and they chase me with a box of cookies. I don't know why they're still following me.
That's only two boxes now. Prices have gone up. It's $5 a box now.
What?
I know.
All I know is Thin Mints eat Girl Scouts.
Thin Mints are good. The Samos are real good.
I just did real camping and I didn't get any cookies. I got those box cereals that you rip the top off of and you pour milk in it.
Oh, I remember those.
And then you eat it. And then maybe some fish you caught on the lake that day.
I went to Jewish summer camp.
Oh.
And we had
what happens there?
Real good food.
Did you drink at a young age?
Sometimes there were bees in the scrambled eggs. But
bees?
Yeah, they would like fly and get mixed in. They'd just leave them. Not bees, probably wasps.
My dad like volunteered to help a class, like a special education class during a fair. And I'm going to get this wrong. Anyways, he cooked something like caramel apples or something where they would like land on bees, yellow jackets, and they get cooked in the food.
I think that's what was happening.
Yeah.
They would just wander into the scrambled egg zone, never to return again.
But would you get stung?
No, they're dead.
I wouldn't eat them.
No, I wouldn't eat them.
Okay.
I mean, there's probably bits.
I didn't know how
I probably
mixed.
Ate bits without really knowing.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you know you didn't get a wing, a leg?
I'm sure I did.
Maybe the little stinger stabbing you in the throat and you wondered why you felt bad all day. And you're.
I'm sure all that happened and more.
Okay.
Tails from Jewish summer camp.
Oh, I was like, I didn't know bees had tails.
No, my tails. That's a whole nother topic.
Bees having tails?
Jewish summer camp.
Oh. Really wrong, my dad said. I don't know, something along those lines. He needs to come back on for another guest appearance to tell that story.
He does. Okay, you ready for the sad part?
Okay.
A family out walking their dog looked over a fence and saw something white. They realized it was a body. The chaplain arrived at Donna's family home at 1 a.m. to speak with them and stayed for several hours. He told her they didn't know if it was Amber or not. The family sat and waited and watched the news to see if there'd be more information. It's estimated that she died on January 15th, 1996. Her body was discovered 2 days later. She was found naked in a little creek bed. It had rained prior to her being discovered, so much of the evidence was unfortunately washed away. Amber's throat had been viciously cut.
No, that's awful.
And they did not say if she was sexually assaulted or not, but the activism that I'll talk about in a minute was geared towards sex offender, so I'm guessing that that may have happened. Police said at the time that maintenance workers at the apartment complex right near the creek had been there just hours before Amber was found, and that she wasn't there. Her body wasn't there. And so what happened was there was this big rainstorm. It caused a rapid rise in the creek water. So her body was carried there from some other location.
Mm.
So we don't know exactly where her body was originally placed. Amber's mom had wanted to see her before the autopsy and hold her one last time, but the police said it wasn't a good idea because her body had been damaged so much and cut so much that she didn't look like Amber anymore. She was finally allowed to see her and talk to her before the funeral. She told Amber that she was glad that she had found her. But when they carried the coffin away, her mom said that it felt like she was losing her all over again.
Mm-hmm. That kind of closure piece, semi-closure.
Well, you know, I've read in some of these that even though it's horrible to have your child found dead, that in some ways is better than never knowing.
Not knowing, that's what I've heard too. Just the questions never mm-hmm. stop.
Yeah.
Versus being able to actually just approach the grief.
Yeah. But this being an unsolved case, I mean, those are lingering things out there, right? Like, there's no justice.
No.
Yes, they know what happened to her and they have her back and they have a grave they can visit, but there's no justice to what happened to her.
Yeah. The anger, the accountability's not taken care of.
Hundreds of stuffed animals had been donated by people that were just well wishers during this. And so Donna donated them all to the women's shelter that had helped her and her children
mm-hmm.
so that the kids staying there would have little stuffies to cuddle.
That's nice.
She continued to stay at her parents' home, which was the last place she had seen Amber alive for some time. She just wasn't ready to leave there.
Mm-hmm.
And Amber's little brother had to be reminded that Amber was in heaven because he would ask where she was.
Mm, you just don't understand.
No, he was only so five. Sad. Donna's role in changing policy began to take shape as she demanded change. She started speaking out at a city council meeting and at a public meeting at Amber's school. She felt like she had to do all she could to find Amber's killer and help protect other children. So she began traveling around the country and advocating for change. She wanted first-time sex offenders to get life in prison without parole. She advocated for one strike. And Amber's father, Richard, joined her in working for change. He said he wasn't there to help Amber, so this was his way of making up for that.
Hmm.
So they're both spurred into action. Because you want to do something. It helps with that feeling of helplessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Some action behind the feelings of
doing something with it. Something
productive.
Positive, productive.
Mm-hmm. You can help somebody else.
2 weeks after Amber's death, Donna decided it was time to leave her parents' house. So she took her son, Ricky, and returned to their apartment. And this was the first time they were going to be there without Amber. And, you know, everything was just as they had left it. Amber's backpack was right by the front door where she dropped it after school. She had her little baggie full of brownie badges on top.
Oh.
A puzzle she was working on was unfinished on the kitchen table. So, and this was all filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. It was just very emotional to watch all this.
Yeah,
because I could feel it, like that whole, like, wow, life just in a second is completely changed forever.
Yeah, that comment of like, I couldn't even imagine, like that steps you into at least a portion of what that could have mm-hmm. looked like.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the feelings, I don't think you would ever actually be able to feel unless it happened. But.
And then Amber's grandfather went to the police station to pick up her things, her bike.
Gosh, I'm sure her grandparents felt awful too. Like they're, you know, they're visiting and then this happened at their house. Like the guilt, I'm sure.
Oh, there's probably so much guilt. So he got her bike, her teddy bear, and her Pocahontas sheets that the police had collected. But there's no suspect. The FBI did release a profile. White or Hispanic male, age 25 or older. And they...
That's broad.
They gave some psychological indicators that the timing of the crime might be related to a personal stress that the person was experiencing at that time. So that could be like a relationship loss, a job loss, something like that.
So they were leaning towards the opportunistic,
but I think that something was bubbling under there already. And then all of a sudden it's like, here's this opportunity. And like this person felt pushed to that at that point.
But if it was like a serial killer and that was his, and he saw her on the news, that would fit that direction too.
Mm-hmm. So if you know somebody at that time that was undergoing stress and had that pickup and was in that area, please report it. The FBI said they believed Amber's killer kept her alive for up to 48 hours after she was abducted. This was especially terrible news for Amber's family. It hit Donna really hard because she's picturing all the horrible torture that Amber was likely undergoing in that 48 hours. That's a long time, 48 hours. And the most impactful thought that came to Donna during this was that Amber could have been saved in that 48 hours if different systems were in place. And so that's part of what led eventually to the Amber Alert system being created.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was this period of time that she could have been saved, that she was alive, 48 hours.
And so, now you see those all over the freeway.
Phone.
The silver alert for
old people,
for elderly or confused.
Yeah.
Yes.
You'll see one of those for me one day. Silver alert.
It'll be
Jade green, Volkswagen Passat.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to see it. I'm going to be like, oh, man. She's down by the river getting pulled into the woods by some lady.
Down by the river. It's always that, right? So Amber's family at this time, very angry, understandably. There's no suspect. They have no one to focus their anger on. So they really put their focus on strengthening laws against sex offenders. Amber's family met with the man, Stuart Coker, who had discovered Amber's body at the creek when he was walking his dog. He showed them the spot. He walked them down to the spot, described everything for them because they wanted to know, that, you know, part of their process. He told them he knew right away that it was a body. Stuart became haunted by this experience. And in the weeks following his discovery, he would go down every day to rake the creek, trying to find evidence. Mm. So a lady named Diane Simone was watching the news about Amber's case. And she's the one that came up with this idea for the Amber Alert. She thought of having an alert system similar to like weather alerts or civil defense alerts that already were in existence. And her idea got established as the Amber Alert System, which stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response Alert System. So this is known as the Amber Alert and is named in Amber Hagerman's honor. So whenever a child's abducted, law enforcement sends an alert to radio and television stations, lottery systems, the Department of Transportation, etc. And then these centers send it to a wider audience.
Mm-hmm. And we had someone jump into the chat here, CPT Jimmy, who was sharing a little bit about like the psychological impact for Amber not knowing what's going to happen, like during that time frame, you know, being captured.
Horrific.
Yeah, the psychological torture that goes into it, not let alone physical.
And she's only 9.
Yeah, I mean,
so not even fully understanding, just
yeah, not able to probably comprehend. Raw other than fear. Yeah, just terror.
So in the aftermath of Amber being killed, the broadcasters in the Dallas-Fort Worth area partnered with law enforcement to develop the Amber Alert system. And in 1998, just a couple years after this, an 8-week-old Arlington infant named Ray Lee Bradbury became the first child rescued as a result of an Amber Alert. This baby had been kidnapped by her babysitter and was found 90 minutes after the alert went out. And so
there's so many people driving and truck stops, gas stations, like all mm-hmm. those places. I mean, why wait for the police to get informed? Why wait for them to find it? Like, there's eyes everywhere.
And how it just pops on your phone. Like, you can't ignore that, you mm-hmm. know, it just right there. And you have the car to kind of look out for,
mm-hmm.
license plate, etc.
I always have that fear that it's going to pop up with my car and people are going to freak out. And then it's like going to be one letter off of my license plate or something.
They do a pit maneuver.
That's my irrational fear when I see those signs.
Amber Alerts have saved more than 1,000 abducted children's lives. That's a lot of lives.
Yeah.
So Donna says she's very proud that the alert system bears her daughter's name. She says, it saved children's lives. It's helped bring children back to mommy and daddy. It's another legacy for my daughter that she did not die in vain. She is still taking care of our little children like she did when she was here.
Well, and if we didn't have those parents advocating for change, it may never have happened, or it may have taken much longer. And more kids could have been victims. So it is a good impact of a horrible situation.
And one other change that came from Amber's death was the creation of a national sex offender registry.
Oh, that came from that too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which did not exist prior.
Yeah.
There continues to be a $10,000 reward offered for new information that would lead to arrest and indictment. There has still been only one witness in these entire 25 years.
The man that died 2 months after.
Yeah. A couple of weeks
ago. It's amazing to think that. Were there no cameras?
This is 96. It wasn't so camera heavy as now.
Hmm. Okay.
So on the 25th anniversary, which was January 13th, a couple of weeks ago, Sergeant Ben Lopez, who is a member of the original task force, said they are pleading if there's anyone out there that has information, even if they think it's just a small bit of information, it may be the lead we need to break this. And authorities have also disclosed for the first time that they have DNA evidence in this case. They have a small amount of DNA evidence that they've been keeping this whole time.
So if a suspect comes up, they could be able to tell if he, she was involved.
Yes. And there's also new DNA technology that's coming up right now too, including genetic genealogy, which can help law enforcement tie these cases with suspects. Yes.
Where was this at again?
Arlington, Texas.
Arlington, Texas.
So the lead investigator on this cold case said he would not disclose what the physical evidence is because he said it's information only Amber's killer would be aware of. And that the evidence has been secured and maintained for the past 25 years with the hope it would someday provide a vital lead. So later this year, this evidence is going to be submitted for testing with the new technology. So Sergeant Ben Lopez, who is on the original task force, really believes that there are more witnesses who are in the area but have not spoken out. He said, it is possible that there were other witnesses who saw what happened but were fearful about coming forward. With it being a Saturday afternoon, that was nice, and a laundromat being right next door to the abduction, we were concerned that there could be people that were there at the laundromat who may have been undocumented and living in this country illegally. So they really want to stress that they have no interest in deporting anybody, and that that is not going to be an issue if that is a fear for coming forward.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody wanted to come forward, who should they contact? Where should they reach out to? We're not taking calls specifically for this. We would rather be able to contact the people closest.
If you have information, you will call Arlington Detectives at 817-575-8823.
Say again one more time slowly. I'll put it in there in the chat box.
Okay. That made me cough. 817-575-8823. My phone voice made me cough. So I just want to repeat the description. So Amber was 9 years old at the time. She was 4'11", brown hair with bangs, freckles. She was taken from the parking lot in an abandoned Winn-Dixie as she rode her pink and white bicycle. The sole witness reported that a white or Hispanic man, upwards of age 25, driving a black pickup, kidnapped her. So suspect, 20s to 30s, under 6 feet tall, medium build, brown or black hair. The vehicle is a black 1980s or 1990s, full size, fleet side pickup truck, short wheelbase, single cab, rear window that is clear, so no sliding window, and no chrome, no striping, and the truck was in good condition. Here's a little picture of little Amber. Look how cute.
Oh, she is cute. So, yes, we don't typically take calls during the podcast, but if you're interested in sharing or talking about something, we do take special guests. If you want to reach out to us on our Facebook page, Deeply Disturbing Things, feel free to reach out. Send us a message.
Do it.
Yeah, we just do a couple screener questions because we're counselors. We just want to make sure that
that you're safe and that we're safe.
Yeah, good job.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My cider is gone. I think I have to go get some more.
Mine too.
Is this intermission time?
Intermission, because I get to go next. Are you done?
Yeah. That's
okay. That's so it. At this point in the podcast, we
go pee, we
drinks. We refill the beverages, and I actually get to go next. So we both have topics that we don't know ahead of time for each other. That way we get genuine responses from each other. And so it's about my turn to go next once I get my beverage. Let's see here.
There you go.
So the person who witnessed back then, how old was that man?
He was like 78.
Did you fall into your
seat? He was like 78.
He was like 78 years old. So he was an older gentleman. He saw the pickup truck through a chain link fence, and there was a strip mall like behind that.
Yes. I think he was like probably in his yard, and there was like a chain link fence.
So he witnessed it. He didn't know it was like a problem, like something unusual.
No, he definitely did. That's why he went in and called 911.
Okay, so he was the one that called.
Yeah.
So was he too far away to see a license plate?
I'm assuming so.
Old eyes, maybe.
Well, and it was across a parking lot.
Okay. So he was the one that called 911, but he did not get a license plate.
And right at that same time,
he died 2 months later.
He died 2 months later, so he couldn't be re-interviewed. And right about that same time is when Amber's grandpa showed up looking for her. And so the police were already arriving, mm-hmm. and he had to go back and tell the family.
Yes. And what we had talked about was that this kind of strip mall that they were at where this bike ramp was, people who were working there had left about an hour earlier, right?
No.
No?
The Winn-Dixie was
Winn-Dixie
abandoned, but there was a laundromat right next door that was open. And okay, that's where the police are hoping that
somebody saw something, but nobody has come out.
But the police think they were maybe undocumented and were afraid to come forward. So the police want to make it very clear that they are not interested in deporting anybody. They just want to solve
information.
This case.
Yeah. I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Because there's a large Hispanic population there in the area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thoughts are that.
Sorry, lots that was of, very loud.
There may be lots of undocumented folks that just, you know, are living there and doing their thing, but don't want to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. That was good. I knew that the Amber Alert came from a real child abduction case, but I had never dived into it. So thank
me
you.
Me either.
Yeah, that was good.
I wanted to do that to find out because same with me. And I, you know what? I also learned a new word.
What?
Backronym.
A backronym?
Backronym. So Amber, the word Amber in the Amber mm-hmm. Alert is a backronym. So it's where you start with the word and then you make the words to stand for each letter.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Instead of an acronym.
Yeah.
Got it.
You work backwards.
Got it.
We're becoming so smart because of this podcast.
So conversational. So my topic today is one that has again been brought up in passing on different various topics, but I'm going to talk about the Tuskegee experiment, the syphilis study.
Awesome. I'm looking at me writing it on our spreadsheet.
Good job.
Because if I don't, on Friday, I'll text you and say, Macy, what was your topic?
We have the worst memory.
We do.
3 days after this podcast when we're trying to remember it. So and feel free to share if you've heard about the Tuskegee experiment, the infamous syphilis study. The Tuskegee experiment began in 1932 at a time where there was no known treatment for syphilis, which is a contagious venereal disease. After being recruited by the promise of free medical care, 600 African-American men in Macon County, Alabama, were enrolled in the project, which aimed to study the full progression of the disease. So they actually reached out to these people and said, we're going to give you free medical care if you will come and be part of our study. And these people have a venereal disease in order to participate. So obviously the free medical care was appealing. And in that time, impoverished communities may not have had access to medical care. The participants were primarily sharecroppers, and many had never before visited a doctor. Doctors from the U.S. Public Health Services, which was running the study, informed the participants, 399 men with latent syphilis and a control group of 201 other men free of the disease, that they were being treated for bad blood, a term commonly used for a variety of ailments. So we're going to treat you for bad blood, is what they would tell them.
Well, isn't that what they used to do leeches for and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of other...
Out with the bad, in with the good.
Yes. You get to watch chat now.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll watch the chat.
I can't read two things. We like that you're sharing. Please keep doing that. We're just trying to juggle and drink cider at the same time.
I'll juggle the cider in the chat. You talk about the syphilis.
And I'll drink the cider. Okay. So these men were monitored by healthcare workers, but only given placebos like aspirin and mineral supplements, despite the fact that penicillin was already recommended for syphilis in 1947, some 15 years into the study. So they already knew effective treatments and they weren't giving it to them.
Withholding treatment is not ethical.
It is not, no. So this was actually, the researchers convinced local physicians in Macon County to treat the participants, and instead research was done at the Tuskegee Institute, which is now Tuskegee University, a school founded in 1881 by Booker T. Washington, who was the first teacher. In order to track the disease's full progression, researchers provided no effective care as the men died. Many men went blind. Some went insane in the sense that they lost faculty of themselves or experienced other severe health problems due to their untreated syphilis. So this venereal disease was really degenerative and could cause a lot of health problems, including death, and they weren't treated at all for any of their symptoms.
And didn't their partners also go untreated?
Mm-hmm. For a while. Yeah, I'll share kind of the timeline here in a little bit because it stretches out for a while.
I'm watching the chat. You don't got to lean forward.
I'm sorry. It's habit.
Do you not trust me?
No, I don't.
I am chat. I am on it.
Can you see it?
I'm looking at it right now. Okay. Got my glasses on. Okay. Looking at it.
All right. I trust you.
I'm on the asshole patrol.
Not just asshole patrol. Like if there's any questions or.
Oh, okay.
Be helpful.
I'm helpful. I'm helpful as fuck.
All right. Okay, so in the mid-1960s, as the venereal disease investigators in San Francisco named Peter Buxton found out about the Tuskegee study, he expressed concerns to his superiors about it being unethical. In response, the officials formed a committee to review the study, but ultimately opted to continue it. So it was reviewed, and they continued it anyways, with the goal of tracking the participants until they all had died. Literally the goal of the study. Autopsies were performed and the project data would then be analyzed. I mean, horribly unethical. Wouldn't pass any ethics IRB review.
Never.
Now. Buxton then leaked, and part of that reason is because of research studies like this. Buxton then leaked the story to a reporter who was a friend of his, who passed it on to a fellow reporter, and that broke the story in July 1972, prompting public outrage, forcing the study to be shut down. By that time, 28 participants died from syphilis. 100 more had passed away from related complications. At least 40 spouses had been diagnosed with it, and the disease had been passed to 19 children at birth. The impact of that is just mind-baffling, of not just the person, but generations impacted by the spread of syphilis.
It's outrageous.
In 1973, Congress held hearings on the Tuskegee experiments, and the following year, the study's surviving participants, along with their heirs of those who died, received a $10 million out-of-court settlement. Additionally, new guidelines were issued to protect human subjects in government-funded research projects. As a result of the Tuskegee experiment, many African Americans developed a lingering deep mistrust of public health officials and vaccines. In part to foster racial hearing, President Bill Clinton, just in 1997, issued an apology statement saying the United States government did something that was wrong, deeply, profoundly, morally wrong. It is not only in remembering that shameful past that we can make amends and repair our nation, but it is in remembering that past that we can build a better present and better future. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that the health disparities that we see in Blacks compared to whites is in part due to the justified mistrust that Blacks have in the medical system because of the long documented history of abuse. Well, medical abuse.
And we see that in mental health as well.
Yeah, it's all one system.
Yeah, I mean, the trust to go and see a provider is much lower, and rightfully so, honestly. It hasn't been that long.
There's so much documented. I mean, and so for psychology, like there's a history of Blacks being overdiagnosed with schizophrenia.
Yes, yes.
And in medical, there's a history of Blacks being underprescribed pain medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Because back in the slavery times, somehow there was the fucked up notion that that blacks don't feel pain like whites.
Mm-hmm. That they should be able to tolerate it.
That they just didn't feel it as thing. And so prior to this experiment you're talking about, there was a horrific experiment done on women without anesthetics whatsoever at all. It all makes sense when you look at it systemically.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, I mean, not that having sense is a solution, but it's understandable how we got to this place. Now, how do we get out of it? I don't know.
It's the viewing of certain populations as lesser than or somehow genetically different than, and then changing your system to fit that. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, I mean, voting, access to health care. I mean, you talked about women's rights, just even a woman being able to go to a doctor without her husband present. Like, these things are not that far back in our history.
Oh, implicit bias absolutely exists today in our profession, in the medical profession, in institutions, you know, schools, organizations, everywhere. It's absolutely a fact. Racism exists in Israel. Mm-hmm. If anybody had any doubts. Some people do, Maisie.
I know, they do.
I feel like I've seen it.
I've like, seen it. Even the people who strongly say that like white privilege isn't a thing, it's not about saying that you're bad or that you've done something wrong. What it means is that me as a white female, when I get pulled over in my car, I don't worry about, I'm just crying because of the stress of being pulled over, but I'm not worried about being shot. I'm not worried about if I reach for something that may be viewed a certain way. I don't even think about that. It never goes in my mind.
Well, that's told a privilege. Both of my boys, even though Skylar looks pretty white, but you know, Asher's brown, and but I've told them both, like, when you get pulled over, you keep your hands on that wheel until they tell you to get out your license and registration. You do not reach for anything. Hands on the fucking wheel until they have eyes on you.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately this shit happens.
Yeah, it does. It does.
And it's, you know, black and indigenous people that are more killed, black and indigenous males that are more killed by police officers than anybody else.
And it's not necessarily like somebody is targeting somebody, but it's what you said, that implicit bias.
Implicit bias.
Of longstanding systemic racial, even religious concepts that are just ingrained generationally even. Okay, so as a result of that Tuskegee experiment, many African Americans developed a lingering mistrust. And with that then came kind of a long history up to this point even where they're not accessing medical services or mental health services statistically on par with other populations. Tuskegee wasn't the first unethical syphilis study, actually. So in 2010, then President Barack Obama and other federal officials apologized for a U.S.-sponsored experiment conducted decades earlier in Guatemala. In that study, from 1946 to 1948, nearly 700 men and women, prison soldiers, mental patients, that's their word, not mine, were intentionally infected. Ooh. What?
I accidentally Googled syphilis. Don't do it.
Ew.
I can't make it go away.
Close it. I just saw like a reflection in your glasses.
Don't do it, people. Me. Do not Google syphilis and then click images. Don't do it.
Not a laughing matter, but I feel bad for you right now. Okay. Where was I? So they were intentionally infected with syphilis. Hundreds more people were exposed to other sexually transmitted diseases as part of the study, most of them without their knowledge or their consent. Some people were raped. Some people were kind of guided into situations without being informed that the other person had syphilis. The purpose of this study was to determine whether penicillin could prevent, not just cure, syphilis infections. Some of those who became infected never received medical treatment. The results of the study, which took place with the cooperation of the Guatemalan government, were never published. The American public health researchers in charge of the project, Dr. John Cutler, went on to become a lead researcher in the Tuskegee experiments.
And now do you see why I trust no one?
Trust no one.
It's a good safety measure.
Burn your journal, trust no one.
Trust no one. Question everything.
Following Cutler's death in 2003, historian Susan Reverby uncovered the records of the Guatemala experiments while doing research related to Tuskegee. She shared her findings with the U.S. government in 2010. Soon afterwards, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Secretary of Health Human Services Kathleen Sebelius issued an apology for those experiments in Guatemala as well. But these are all like government-funded research. Somebody with a degree approved that to happen. WTF MFers.
It's all about that power.
Well, and it's that same thing with psychology back and, you know, horrible forms of treatment of psychology or of like mental health in institutions. It's all in the name of science or betterment. And there have been things learned from that, but at what cost? And is that cost worth it? And that's now what there's the IRB. You have to prove.
Make a case that any detriments are worth a benefit to humanity.
What protections are you putting in place? What resources are you putting in place for any damages that might occur? And then they weigh it out and say whether they agree with you or not. And they're an actual independent group that does those reviews. Okay, so yes, you were talking about the people who, like the family members.
Mm-hmm.
So, in just kind of wind back here, in 1926, health is seen as inhibiting development in major health initiatives. So the U.S. government starts focusing on health more. The prevalence of 35% observed in reproductive age population. So syphilis started increasing to 35% in the observed reproductive age of the population. So it was increasing. The U.S. government wanted some sort of solution. Aggressive treatment approaches started to show up around 1929 with mercury and mismuth. Do you know what that is?
No.
I don't know what that is either. Bismuth, B-I-S-M-U-T-H. Look it up. Cure rate is less than 30%. Treatment requires months, and side effects are toxic and sometimes fatal.
Could you spell that again?
Yeah. B-I-S-M-U-T-H.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's odd. Bismuth.
There's a YouTube tutorial, how to make bismuth crystals.
We don't. Whatever that is, we're not recommending it.
We don't want that.
30% effective and you can die. So let's not.
Don't make them.
Don't do it. What is it made out of?
A brittle crystalline white metal with a slight pink tinge. Has a variety of uses, including cosmetics, alloys, fire extinguishers.
So it's like a ammunition. Metal base?
It is also known as the main ingredient in Pepto-Bismol. Bismuth Bismol makes sense.
Oh, see, learning things.
Learning.
Mm-hmm. So, 1929, this is also when the Wall Street crash happened. The economic depression hit right around this time. So, moving forward, 1931, the Rosenwald Fund cuts support to developmental projects, which they started to leave people untreated. As money was becoming less and funding was dropping. 1932 was the follow-up efforts organized into studying the syphilis group. Moton agrees, so Moton was one of the people involved, agrees to support the study if Tuskegee Institute gets its full share of the credit. So like the university really wanted to be involved in getting credit for this study.
Fame, power, control.
Mm-hmm. In 1934, the first paper suggests health effects of untreated syphilis came out. In 1936, a major paper was published criticizing criticizing the men who were being untreated. Local physicians asked to assist with the study. They were ultimately asked to not to treat the men. Decision was made to follow the men until death. In 1940, efforts made to hinder men from getting treatment ordered until the military draft effort, or under the military draft effort. 1945, penicillin accepted as treatment of choice. So we're still in the middle of this treatment period, and penicillin becomes a treatment option, and they still choose to not give it. 1962, black medical students are rotating through units doing the study. So they start getting actual black medical students who are now witnessing what's happening. 1968, concerns start to get raised. 1969, the CDC reaffirms need for study and gains local medical support in the community.
When did the study start?
Well, it was way back. It started in...
So it was a long-term
study. Yeah, like 1926. Yeah, I mean, so it spanned a long period of time.
Multi-generational.
Until people died, yeah. 1972, the first news articles condemning the study happened in 1972. So that's only a few years after, a couple of years after the CDC is like, yes, we really need to do this. And then it gets shut down because it got publicized in the media. Which if you think about 1972, there's more public media happening than earlier on. In 1974, there was a class action lawsuit for participants. That $10 million court settlement was reached. The U.S. government also promised to give lifetime medical benefits and burial services to all living participants, the Tuskegee Health Benefit Program.
It's like too little, too late.
Right? Like, okay, you killed me, you killed my wife, and my child. Thanks for the burial service.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks a lot. And that $10 million spread across all those people, across all those funerals and generational aspects of health, I mean, medical expenses through all of that, because they didn't provide it all. So if they got treatment after the study, they would have had to pay for it.
Jesus.
So, I mean, that money goes away really quick. 1975 was when wives and widows and offsprings were added to the program. So there was a gap there before they were added. The program was expanded to include health as well as medical benefits. And in 1997, that's when Clinton apologized for the study.
When did the study actually stop?
The study stopped in 1972.
So 26 to 72. That's a long ass time.
Mm-hmm. And then it took from 72 when the study ended until 1997 until there was a government apology.
And that was Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he was the one that apologized for us illegally annexing Hawaii, the Kingdom of Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Our state. So
yeah,
I guess he was the apology president.
The apology president, for sure.
And then he had to apologize for, like, having sex with that woman.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. Why do they only remember that apology? There's some other bigger apologies. Just saying. In 1990,
he's just a sorry president.
In 1999,
JK, I think I voted for him.
In 1999, Tuskegee University National Center for Bioethics hosted their annual commemoration of the presidential apology. So now we're starting to get into ethical changes that happened. But again, now we're in the 2000s that ethical changes are being made to research. And in 2004, the last U.S. Public Health Service syphilis study participant died January 16th. So in 2004, the last member died.
That's recent.
Mm-hmm. They still host events to talk about the impacts of what happened. The CDC actually hosts a commemoration thing, which just kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Like, you literally advocated for, after it was being condemned, after people were dying, for it to continue. And now you get to host commemorative, like, ceremonies.
That's some real bullshit.
Yeah, I agree. 2009, the last...
Or what you said, a bad taste.
Yeah, some real bad taste bullshit.
Bad taste and bullshit.
In 2009, the last widow received benefits, and she, so the last widow who received benefits died on January 27th, 2009. So that is the syphilis studies of Tuskegee, and they're horrible, and a warning about misuse of participants.
And the repercussions still go on today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, we're seeing in COVID health disparities that I'm sure
are going to be studied after.
Linked, well, at least partly linked to this, the mistrust bred by that.
Yeah, people not seeking health care, not trusting.
Valid mistrust, I should say.
And not trusting what the government says.
Yeah.
Many populations have been just straight up lied to.
And abused and killed.
Mm-hmm.
In the sake of medical help for you.
Yes. Yeah, so it's.
Trust us.
Yeah. It's not saying like don't listen, but it's saying take it with a grain of salt, do your own research, and do what's best for you.
Get information from diverse sources, and then you decide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I could say that like our government's always been in the right, but it just hasn't. It's actually only
our podcast has shown there's been a lot of really fucked up things.
We've covered so many things.
So many.
Yeah. And to be fair, though, other countries aren't much better, and if not worse, in a lot of areas. So, you know, it's global systems problems that need to be addressed or are working on it, but they're not fixed. They're not there yet because these things are historical and they follow.
Yeah, it takes generations sometimes to unwind this stuff, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. That's it. That's all I got.
Okay.
Do you want to give our special group meeting?
Yeah. If you're part of the special cocktails and crafts group, don't forget Friday. But unless you're listening live, you won't hear this until after Friday.
Probably. So yeah.
I guess
probably
kind of pointless.
I'll try to post it before Friday, just in case. Okay. If you're not part of our special group, but like you're like,
you
hey,
really
I kind of like this podcast, and I think I could get on board with listening to more than one episode. Reach out to us on Facebook. We have
or Instagram.
We do special things with our followers, and we do fun stuff. And we're kind of creating our own cult, so that's fun.
Yep.
Yep.
Aletheia. Truth.
All right, we ready to wrap it up?
Sure.
Oh yeah, Sachi, you are so welcome to join. I will send you the link to some information.
Okay. The link to the information.
The link to the stuff that Naomi wrote.
That cannot be more vague, but that's
how I will send you an email with the stuff. It's secret.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay.
Until next time, don't ever Google syphilis and click images.
And until next time, don't believe the bullshit. Thanks, guys. Bye.